welcome to another episode of the Presto Classical Podcast. Most people will have been aware of the Byrd anniversary falling this year, but my guest this week is going to help me shine a light on another Tudor composer who also died in 1623, namely Thomas Weelkes. Personally, I think Weelkes is just brilliant and doesn't get enough love, so I thought I'd do something about it. Joining me in the capacity of Weelkesologist, which is a word I made up when I was first getting in touch with her, is Dr. Katie Bank of the University of Birmingham. Dr. Bank is a Leverholm Early Career Fellow in the Department of History and researches musical visual culture in early modern England, with an interdisciplinary kind of spin on things that involves looking at music's intersection with a whole range of other areas of society. And her own website also marks her out as, and I quote, a choir geek extraordinaire. Dr. Bank, thank you so much for joining me, and I hope I pronounced Leverholm correctly.
I mean, your guess is as good as mine. I think I say Leverhulme, but who knows? I have that funny American accent anyway, so.
How did you yourself first get into the music and indeed the history of this period? Are you a historian who got into music or a musician who got into history or a bit of both?
I suppose a bit of both, but really it came from the music side. I was fortunate enough to, I went to a state school, high school in California, but we had a really great choir. My mother forced me to join the choir, partially against my will, but I'm glad she did, because while I was in that choir, I sang Thomas Weelkes's Siuli, the Period of Cosmography, which we will talk about and listen to in a little bit, but it's just a wonderful piece and completely weird. And I think I was just very intrigued by what the text meant. And it was something I wrote about when I was an undergraduate. And then I wrote about it again in my master's. And then I wrote about it yet again in my PhD. So it's just kind of followed me around. And I think that's really how I got into this period in general.
So there is, from the sounds of it, there is quite a through line from that straight into your academic career.
Yeah, there really is.
Well, we'll come on to Mr. Weelkes, the man, the legend, in a moment. But just before we do that, the musical visual culture thing that I mentioned, which I think is a pretty central strand of your work, as far as I understand it, what exactly is this in the briefest possible terms? And what are the things that it lets us learn and find out that maybe we couldn't in other ways?
So I suppose in the shortest possible terms, I'm trying to see what visual culture can tell us about music making, but not just, you know, how something was played or how many frets were on the, you know, lute or whatever, more about how music made people feel, the emotional aspect of music making, and similarly, what song can tell us about looking and the visual aspects of music making from back then. So I think music making was in general a much more visual thing than we think of today. And I think in part that's because we have a much more, in some ways, sterile concert culture for looking. I mean, you know, people wear all the same clothes. They look very professional and all of that. And the music I look at is generally domestic recreational music. So music that's performed in the home for fun amongst friends. And I think within that context, there's so much to be looking at. And so much to be seeing, and there's a lot to be learned about both sides from looking at those things together.
Among your research, you've published a couple of papers on Weelkes' music, including one that looks at the just wonderfully pictorial madrigal of his that we've just heard a little bit of, Thule, the Period of Cosmography, which was performed by the Kingsingers with fretwork from their album Tom and Will from the start of the year. Just to start us off, can you give us a potted summary of who Weelkes was? As simple as that.
Sure. So the short answer is there's not a lot on Wilkes about who he was, really. So in making, in formulating ideas about who he was, we're looking to two main things. The scant biographical evidence that there is in the records, and also his music. So those are the two main sources. So in terms of his music, he really first pops up in the records when he publishes his first book of song, which, oh, I should have looked this up ahead of time, but I think it's 1597. But it was in that year between when Thomas Tallis and William Byrd had the patent for publishing music and before Thomas Morley took it on later. So it was that in that gap year, kind of between the two patent holders, that's when he published his first book of song, and he did three others. None of his church music was published in print. It only circulated in manuscripts. So that leads us with not a strong idea of when he wrote things or for whom he wrote his church music. So that's a big question mark. But there's evidence of his music, his church music, all over the country in various manuscripts. Some of it's incomplete and has had to be reconstructed by modern editors. But he basically, his biography goes something like this. He was an organist and was in charge of the choristers at Winchester College. And that's when he first started publishing his music in print. And then he took a Bachelor of Music degree from the University of Oxford from New College. And at this time, it was kind of a more portfolio style degree. So it didn't mean that he necessarily, you know, lived and worked in college. He submitted a portfolio to be examined and to be, you know, he's awarded the degree based on the merit of the portfolio. And that happened, I think, in 1602. And then he was at Chichester Cathedral, where he was, again, in charge of the choristers and employed as organist. Now, the important thing to know there, and we'll talk more about his time at Chichester, I think, a little bit later in the podcast, is that he wasn't actually the head honcho of music making at Chichester. He was those roles, but those roles weren't the person who was in charge of, you know, everybody in the way that those roles are today. So there were people that were more in charge of the music than Wilkes was at Chichester.
As far as Tudor anniversaries go, as I said, this year it's been pretty much Bird, Bird, Bird. And one of the things I'm hoping to do is to redress the balance a bit and put the spotlight onto Wilkes. But all the same, I think some comparison with Bird is sort of unavoidable, just if only because of the shared anniversary. Bird's got all that religious soul-searching in his life. He's being torn between Protestantism and Catholicism, and a lot of the accounts you read about him really play that idea of him being buffeted about by the sort of political storms of his time. Does Wilkes have a similarly tricky time of it in that sort of ideological values sort of sense, or not so much really?
It's really hard to say with Wilkes because there's so much more written evidence about Byrd for a few reasons. One, because Byrd was a gentleman of the Chapel Royal, so he was much closer to court. We'll talk about Wilkes's affiliation with the Chapel Royal perhaps a little bit later. Wilkes is probably an extraordinary gentleman of the Chapel Royal, but perhaps not in the Chapel Royal itself. But also, Byrd in particular got in a lot of legal troubles, and that legal troubles, for better or for worse, gives you evidence of what's going on. So Byrd's wife got into some legal trouble for her Catholic leanings first, and then Byrd did as well. And Byrd also, you know, sued people. He got into, like, lawsuits. He was a bit of a stubborn one, and so he pops up in legal records a lot more than Wilkes does. Wilkes has some records from the chapter acts at Chichester Cathedral, but it's not necessarily strictly about confession or about whether he was a Protestant or a Catholic. So in terms of Wilkes's inner leanings, it's a lot harder to say. He didn't write any explicitly Latin music except for one piece, the Laboravi in Gemitu. That's his only entirely Latin piece. His other Latin works, like Gloria in Excelsis Deo, those are macaronic, so they're a mix of Latin and English text, which would have been more appropriate for an Anglican service. So there, in short, is less evidence about his inner feelings towards everything going on. when in doubt, I tend to think that a lot of musicians, including Bird, had to think very practically in this time. They had to be employed. They had to, you know, keep their, manage their musical well-being with their practical, you know, who's in charge and their spiritual well-being. So, you know, I would like to think Wilkes was a bit of a pragmatist, if nothing else.
My own familiarity with Wilkes' music is limited to some of his canticles and anthems that I've sung over the years, such as the one we've just heard a bit of, which was Hosanna to the Son of David, sung by Christchurch Cathedral Choir, conducted by Stephen Darlington on a recording from the late 80s. But there is, of course, a lot of other music by him, and in particular there's the consort works and there's all these madrigals. One of them that I think is particularly sweet is the one that's called Death Hath Deprived Me, which we'll hear a little bit later on. It reminds me so much of Bird's Ye Sacred Muses. It's almost sort of the same thing. Bird is mourning the death of Talis, who was a great friend of his. And in Death Hath Deprived Me, I think Wilkes is doing basically the same thing. He's creating a musical elegy for his own friend, which in this case was Thomas Morley. How much do we know about that friendship? Is it a professional collaboration? Are they colleagues or are they actual friends? Or again, is it a bit of both?
It's probably a bit of both. So it's possible. So one of the things that Wilkes got in trouble for while he was at Chichester was absenteeism. Now, as I'll mention later, absenteeism was rife amongst basically all the musicians at Chichester. So this was not exclusive to Wilkes. But one thought is perhaps while he was away from Chichester, he spent some time in London. And we know that Wilkes had at least a business or working relationship with Thomas Morley, because he did publish 3 out of his 4 printed books when Morley held the patent for music printing. Death Hath Deprived Me, I agree, it's a wonderful piece. And it's sort of unique amongst Wilkes's texts in that it's one of the few pieces that we know the text author of. So it was, the lyrics were written by Sir John Davies in honor of Henry Herbert, who is part of the second Earl of Pembroke, and he's part of the Sidney and Leicester circles. It's a fairly madrigalian setting for an elegy, which I think makes total sense for someone, you know, if you're writing an elegy for Thomas Morley, who first imported all of those Italian madrigals, or was one of, had a hand in first bringing those Italian madrigals over. So things like when they talk about engrave, it goes down, I think, to like a bottom D in the original, so it's very, very low for the basses. But in short, one can only assume they had some sort of friendship, but in terms of actual records, it was at least a business relationship, if not something more. But the words of this song would suggest perhaps it was something more.
One of the things for which Wilkes has become known, or possibly infamous, is his consistently bad behaviour. While he was at Chichester, he seems to have been regularly disciplined for drunkenness and bad language during the services. This came out actually the other day when I was reading Andrew Parrott's great new book of primary sources on early music, which incidentally is fantastic and I recommend. And there's a whole section in it on the behaviour of church musicians. And I need to be a little bit careful here because my parents listen to this podcast, but let's call this wayward laddishness. How true are the stories? And if they are true, how unusual is Wilkes in this respect? Was everybody just behaving like this?
Well, I hate to burst all bubbles, but I think the main story you hear, and it's in surprising places on the internet that you'd think would perhaps know better, but the story goes that he urinated from the organ loft onto the head of the Dean of Chichester. I have yet...
That's the story I've heard, yes. And I always find it fascinating that that would be something that you would do and be disciplined for, but not sacked.
And not sacked.
That, to me, is a sackable offence.
You would think. And I think it probably would have been, because I have yet to see any actual evidence that this happened. I would love to find out where that rumour started. I suspect lay clerks, but I'm not going to point any fingers. But, you know, there was some... That's not to say that there wasn't some truth to it. So I think... It's kind of like the story of Mozart visiting the Sistine Chapel and hearing the Allegri Miserere and writing it from memory. You know, it's a rumor that gets perpetuated through program notes, through storytelling. I mean, we're telling it again right now, you know, but it probably isn't rooted entirely in reality. So Chichester is where this all went down. And in the record chapter acts, there are references to Wilkes getting in trouble for, you know, for drunkenness, for frequenting the tavern and that sort of thing. However, as I haven't read The Parrot yet, but as you suggest, this is not unique behavior amongst musicians. What musicians do you know that don't like going to the pub after rehearsal? And I think on the whole, the evidence in the Chapter Acts books of Chichester suggest that they were trying to crack down on musician and other lay behavior at the cathedral, rather than the behavior of the musicians being extraordinary in any particular way, particularly for a, not that it's that far, but a more provincial cathedral where musicians did have to go do things in other places. And, you know, it took a while to travel places back then. So Wilkes denied all the charges against him and they were settled to the satisfaction of the authorities out of the courts, so one can only assume that it wasn't as bad as perhaps the rumor suggests. And the chapter acts also suggest one of my favorite little anecdotes is they got really upset because musicians were bringing their dogs to choir rehearsal, and they decided to enforce a fine of a sixpence if you brought your dog to services. So I think that just kind of gives you a little bit of an indication of the idea that the authorities there were just trying to rein things in a bit.
Wilkes's music did enjoy a little boost in popularity in May of this year, when his anthem, O Lord, Grant the King a Long Life, was performed as part of the coronation of King Charles and Queen Camilla. That little excerpt that we've just heard was from the official coronation album, as performed by Westminster Abbey Choir and conducted by the recently appointed organist and master of the choristers, Andrew Nefsinger. But all the same, I think it's fair to say that today, Wilkes is perhaps not the most prominent Tudor composer in most people's minds. And I was wondering, how did that compare to his reputation in his own time? Was he a much bigger dog? Sorry, it's dogs again. Mm-hmm. Was he a much bigger dog then than he is now?
So on the cover of his 1608 Airs and Fantastic Spirits, Wilkes says that he was a gentleman of the Chapel Royal. And this has always been a bit of a curiosity, because you wouldn't just put that on the front of your publication unless you did have some sort of legitimacy to that claim. However, his name doesn't appear in any of the official Chapel Royal records. So as I mentioned earlier, they think that perhaps he was an extraordinary gentleman of the Chapel Royal, meaning he was not in the inner circles, but he was affiliated with and kind of from afar had this affiliation. So I think that probably is true, and that probably tracks. His music was fairly well circulated, and his prints were owned by some prominent late Elizabethan, early Stuart families, like the Cavendishes, I think, owned his books. They owned everybody, but they owned his books of print. And his music circulated enough in manuscript that you know that it was liked by people and circulated in that fashion. His name isn't dropped in written sources in the way that Byrd's is, or even other composers such as Michael East. I think they both end up being mentioned by, I believe, George Putnam, but don't quote me on that because I'm just going off the top of my head. But you get people like Byrd who are mentioned and name-checked in written sources from non-musicians as being one of the greats of that era. Alongside Lassus and these continental composers. You don't get that with Byrd. But that's not to say that is a reflection on his domestic reputation, because people like Byrd had to be name-checked because they were Elizabeth's favorite. They, you know, there were political and courtly reasons to name-check Byrd in things. So I think, I think he probably was decently well-respected as a musician in his time.
In terms of today, then, have you seen any changes sort of recently in how he's regarded? Have there been new bits of scholarship, new recordings, things like that have helped to bring him a bit back into the limelight?
Yeah, it's been piecemeal, but over the last, basically since the 90s or so, there have been articles that have kind of redressed his reputation, largely built by his biographer who did wonderful work, David Brown. And David Brown is, you know, we have so much to thank David Brown for in terms of knowing about Wilkes's biography. But, you know, he was of a certain generation and he really took a lot of the drunken disorderly accusations to heart in terms of how Wilkes succeeded or failed ultimately as a musician. And I think nowadays scholars perhaps won't go at it in the same way in terms of making that success or fail accusation. And scholars like Philip Brett have done a lot of work, and there's some other literary scholars who've done some work to redress the idea that Wilkes was in any way stupid or an underachiever because of the types of texts he set. He set a lot of what earlier generations of literary scholars might have called frivolous texts, you know, the skipping through fields of daisies type madrigalian stuff. And I think literary scholars such as Joseph Ortiz, who's in the U.S. in Texas, are doing really nice work in redressing the idea that his texts were frivolous, or the idea that perhaps Wilkes was an underachiever and that he achieved just as much as he achieved, and you don't need to compare him to to others. I think in terms of recordings, there's still a lot that could be done with Wilkes in terms of his three voice stuff, but for practical economic reasons, I completely understand why, you know, no choir has taken up the helm to really record the three voice works from Airs and Fantastic Spirits. They're less recorded, they're less performed by ensembles as well, by amateur ensembles, because, you know, one of the four parts, if not two of the four parts, have to sit out for in order for you to sing one of those. And also, they're quite dirty. They've got a lot of in-jokes. They've got a lot of political and topical and sexual innuendo that's kind of beyond our sense of humor. So they don't have perhaps the same charm that they once had, unless you're in the know about the texts.
Yeah, it's sort of it sort of gets you coming and going, because you might on the one hand be shy of the innuendo, but also if it's satire from his time, then a lot of the gags just won't land.
Exactly. And, you know, the Kingsingers do some of those. They're one of the few groups that do some of those. But all they can do is give a little wink, you know? They can't really do too much. They have an all-ages audience, so, yeah.
Katie, thank you so much. Thank you for taking the time to join me today and share some of your expertise. It's so nice to be able to sort of draw people's attention to such a great composer, and fingers crossed we'll have managed to make a few converts today.
Thank you very much, David.
My thanks, as ever, also go to our producer at Presto, Matt Groom, and of course to all of you for listening. I normally like to round episodes off by mentioning a newly released album that's connected to the things we've been talking about, and to my immense joy, there is indeed a new album of music by Wilkes out this November. Appropriately enough, it's called Gentleman Extraordinary. It's on Resonance Classics, and it's got a selection of his music performed by the Irish vocal ensemble Resurgam and the English Cornet and Sackbut Ensemble. I think it's Cornet and Sackbut, possibly Sackbut and Cornet. It's available on the Presto website, prestomusic.com, as a CD to download in a variety of formats, including in high res, and on our new streaming app, which, if you don't already have it, is also available on the website. So do head over there and check that out if your interest has been sparked by our discussion. And here to play us out is the conclusion of the Magnificat from Wilkes' 9th evening service from Gentleman Extraordinary.